Park, Adam Sinadel v. Shinhan Bank America. Case numbers 252453 and 252656. I understand that all counsel for that matter are present and will therefore dispense with the calling of the calendar.
Thank you.
And we'll start right away then. Mr. Bergstein.
Good morning. May it please the court. Stephen Bergstein for the plaintiffs. Let me start with the arbitration issue. When they initially filed a motion to dismiss the complaint before later moving to compel arbitration about 16 months later, defendants acted inconsistently with their right to arbitrate. That is the core inquiry under Doyle. That is the core inquiry under the Supreme Court's recent case on waiver. And I would say that the language in Doyle articulates something close to a bright line rule in that what defendants did in this case constitutes waiver. This court in Doyle said you can't use a motion to compel as a fallback. You can't get a second bite of the apple. You can't have it both ways. They had a binary choice when served with the complaint, and their first choice was to invoke the district court's authority to resolve the case on the merits.
Counsel, can I just ask you, what do we do in a different situation where, say, somebody files a motion to dismiss, trying to make sure that they get their Rule 12 arguments in a timely manner? And then let's say 1 month later, move for arbitration. Would you, just because you said something about it being like a bright line, in your view, and I know it's not this case, but in your view, would that litigant also have waived its right to seek arbitration?
Yes. If a decision has to be made on that, I would say yes, because of the language in Doyle. Doyle closes out the opinion with some very interesting language that Doyle doesn't seem to consider it material that in the parties in that case moved to compel after the motion to dismiss was denied. In Doyle, they wrap up the opinion, the UBS defendants acted inconsistently.
Why isn't that important? Because it does suggest an effort to get a second bite at the apple, which we don't yet have here.
Because in Doyle, the ultimate holding was by first moving to dismiss, that's waiver. That's how Doyle wraps up the opinion. That's the very last paragraph. There's no accounting for the fact that in Doyle, the motion to dismiss was denied. In our case, they're on very weak ground in stating that they moved to compel before they got a ruling on the motion to dismiss, because the motion to dismiss, that motion had been pending for quite some time. They waited 16 months between entering the case and then telling the district court they wanted to move to compel. That's a long time. You know, 1 month is closer. Maybe there's a mitigating circumstance. 16 months is a long time to wait to exercise your right to arbitrate, and that is inconsistent with the right to arbitrate. The Supreme Court and Doyle simplified the inquiry in many respects, at least for a case like this. If you act inconsistently, you waive.
That can't possibly be right.
What
I file a motion to dismiss. There's a arbitration provision in the agreement. There is a complaint. I file a motion to dismiss, and a day later, I say, "Wait a minute. I'm sorry. There is a arbitration provision." Because I think that you are asking us to create a very bright line. Right. So once you file a motion to dismiss, game over. You're in federal court and you have relinquished your right to arbitrate. So that can't, to me, I think that doesn't sound right.
A day later.
And if you agree with a day later, then why? What is the analytical difference?
I don't know if I agree with a day later without knowing more about why they waited a day. A day is a very, very brief time in the practice of law. Things happen, you couldn't
Some
get it done.
Some people would say in the civil context, a month is a very, very brief time in the practice.
A month is different, because within a month, you know.
What's the analytical difference?
Say it again.
Analytically, what is the difference?
Under Doyle, I don't see an analytic difference. I don't. Doyle seems to say by first moving, you relinquished, by moving to dismiss on the merits, you relinquish your right
so
to arbitrate.
That is not really totally consistent with general principles of waiver. Remember, the Doyle is trying to make sense of Morgan. And Morgan tells us a couple of different things. One, strip out the prejudice analysis, but more importantly, I think for our purposes, focus very much on ordinary principles of waiver. And I don't know that in the ordinary course, we would say that someone has distinctively or party has clearly waived as opposed to forfeited and so on, a right to do anything after a month, after whatever. Just based on a motion to dismiss, what's the difference here?
There might be a reason they waited a month. Maybe they didn't know there was an arbitration agreement. But 16, here, we don't have a month.
Did much happen in the 16 months in the litigation?
Ask it again.
Did anything happen in the 16 months in terms of the litigation?
Not substantively, because there was a motion pending. There was a motion pending. But that motion could have been decided at any time. And if the motion to dismiss was resolved on the merits and they prevailed, then they don't have to worry about arbitration. They got the decision they want. The case is over. They don't have to pay for arbitration anymore. That's the risk you take when you wait that long when the motion is pending.
What if a defendant jointly moves to dismiss and to compel arbitration?
The only case I know of where there was a simultaneous process is out of the Seventh Circuit, cited out of a Southern District case from 2026, Cabintry, 50 F3rd at 390. Simultaneously or sequentially in multiple forums, that's a waiver. That's from Seventh Circuit, not Second Circuit. But the point was, you have a choice. Do you want to litigate? You want to arbitrate. And, you know, one day, there might be a reason to wait a day or 3 days, but this is over a year. And when you're waiting for a decision on the motion to dismiss, you're taking a chance that you get the decision you want. Arbitration's done. We have no control over when motions get decided. So I think the district court got it right here on waiver, and it was a knowing waiver because they drafted the arbitration agreement. They knew the arbitration agreements were in place. And, you know, what is the excuse? New counsel? Well, that's not really an excuse. You rely on the judgment of your first counsel, and they had highly qualified counsel at the outset of the case.
Would you turn, unless my colleagues have got any additional questions, to the motion to dismiss briefly?
Sure. Yes. District court granted the motion to dismiss for lack of a prima facie case because the complaint does not plausibly show that management knew plaintiffs had blown the whistle to the FDIC. That analysis is incorrect. We have circumstantial evidence that the bank was aware that plaintiffs had complained to the FDIC. There are cases in this circuit that say you can plausibly assert knowledge, even on summary judgment, through circumstantial evidence.
What is the circumstantial evidence here?
Circumstantial evidence is as follows. Number one, all four plaintiffs were on the compliance team. They all blew the whistle to the FDIC, and they all were fired relatively quickly after they went to the FDIC. Adamson was only a month. And so the entire team is gone. And for reasons that were pretextual, the complaint sets out that the reasons articulated by defendants for their terminations were not true. So they're trying to get rid of the people who were pushing the bank to comply with the consent order.
So they had made these internal complaints as well, correct?
They did. And that's relevant because assuming the FDIC does its job and notifies the bank that we have these complaints, which is true anytime you make a whistleblowing complaint, and the FDIC would want the bank's response, the bank would know or assume or recognize that it was most likely the plaintiffs who made these complaints because
assume, recognize are three different things. Do you agree that you've got to plausibly allege that the defendant said not that the bank had knowledge?
Yeah, yes. But I think you can plausibly infer that if the FDIC does its job and notifies the bank in a timely manner, the bank would know that it was the plaintiffs who made these complaints because the complaints were in line with the complaints that were raising internally. Who else would have made the complaints? These are all related to compliance with the consent order from
You're not just relying on the fact that there was monitoring of emails. Is that right? I mean, that's part of it.
One of the factors, but it's not the only factor. We have a number of factors, but in the case we're primarily relying on, Jute, you inferred that management knew that Jute was going to be a witness for the plaintiff because Jute was fired quickly and removed from her position. That was enough for this court to find that you can draw the circumstantial inference that management knew that Jute had engaged in protected activity. A contrary ruling would make it very difficult for plaintiffs in cases like this to bring a whistleblowing claim because these are supposed to be confidential complaints. It's not like a complaint to the EEOC where everybody knows that John Doe made a complaint. So at the pleading stage, you can draw the inference that management was aware that plaintiffs had brought these charges, and discovery would focus on that. Well, what communications transpired among management with the FDIC, and what did they say when they found out that the FDIC got these complaints, and what computer monitoring was going on? We don't know any of this because we haven't started discovery.
Can I ask a question about the order of operations for us in this appeal? Because there's an appeal and a cross appeal, and I'll be interested to hear what your opponents say too. Let's say hypothetically, we agree with your opponents that there should have been arbitration, the motion to compel. Do we grant that, or do we send it back to be granted, or do we have to first decide whether the motion to dismiss was properly granted or not? Are there any live claims at that point?
I think if this court finds that there is a legitimate motion to compel, I don't know if this court has authority to rule on the merits. Wouldn't that be for the arbitrator, AAA?
Right? That would be the idea that we would have to vacate. Even if we thought it was right, we would say, well, it wasn't for the district court to think about. It was for the arbitrators. That would be your view?
Yes, and then the arbitrator would decide the merits of the motion.
Wipes the slate clean, and Judge Garifas says, send everything to, notwithstanding what's happened, send everything to the arbitrator, correct?
I think so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I think you reserve some time for rebuttal, so we'll hear from Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is James Nelson, and I represent the defendants. This court should reverse the district court's refusal to compel arbitration of the FIREA and state law claims. A proper application of Doyle's totality of the circumstances test shows that defendants did not waive their right to arbitrate. Only if this court disagrees should it consider and affirm the FIREA dismissal. First, the district court erred in holding that filing a motion to dismiss.
So moving to dismiss and then waiting 16 months, is that not acting inconsistently with the right to arbitrate?
So we'd say no, Your Honor, because what Doyle instructed is that the court needs to look at all aspects of the moving party's conduct, explicitly adopting the totality of circumstances test from Louisiana Stadium, which says there is no rigid.
What else is there in the totality of circumstances?
So all aspects of the moving party's conduct. The other two aspects of the moving party's conduct here that were not looked at by the district court was alerting the parties and the district court about the right to arbitrate and the intention to move to compel arbitration before the decision on the motion to dismiss, and then actually moving to compel and completing that briefing before any decision on the motion to dismiss. Doyle explicitly said that the failure to do those two things underlied its decision that the party in that case was seeking a second bite at the apple or was treating arbitration as a fallback position.
Where is that in the holding? I mean, what it does refer, I'll grant you this, to the fact that the defendants sought to proceed to arbitration only after the motion to dismiss was denied. But when I look at the actual holding, it is just seeking dismissal is enough to conclude that the conduct was inconsistent with the right to arbitrate.
So, Your Honor, I think that the sentence that you're quoting at the end of the decision, I think, has to be read in context. The prior three paragraphs explain the reasoning behind that decision, and the court actually italicized at page 131 the core reasoning. Only after their motion to dismiss was denied did they raise the issue of arbitration. And even in that last sentence, it says, in this case, in footnote 11.
By seeking dismissal, we read these opinions all the time, and I look at, by seeking dismissal in the district court, the UBS defendants availed themselves of the district court's authority to resolve the claims against them. This conduct is inconsistent with the right to arbitrate.
In this case, I think, is the very next sentence in footnote 11, if that's what you're referring to, Your Honor. So it's in the context of that case. At the very beginning of the decision, it says you have to look at all aspects of the moving party's conduct. It did not announce a bright-line rule. It explicitly quoted Louisiana Stadium as saying there is no rigid formula or bright-line rule. You have to look at all of the moving party's conduct. And several courts since Morgan—
Do you agree? I mean, you heard our questions about the temporal proximity, the issues of timing. Do you agree, or would you agree, that if instead of 16 years, and you can see where I'm going, the first lawyers, you're making also a claim about the fact that there was a change in lawyers. First lawyers had waited 2 or 3 years. Would you agree then that that would be, and there was no denial, no resolution of the motion to dismiss? Would you agree that that would be inconsistent with intent to arbitrate?
So assuming there was no other litigation activity, like in this case, then I would say no, Your Honor. In fact, we cited Second Circuit cases saying that periods of time of 2 and 3 years is not enough length of time, specifically in the context where there is not substantial litigation conduct. And I think the other side agreed that there was no substantive litigation conduct at all after the motion to dismiss.
How does the intervening amount of conduct factor into our analysis without effectively becoming a prejudice analysis, right? Because that seems to be why we would care if there had been, I don't know, really expensive discovery, productions, depositions and everything. And you'd say, really, you guys come along and you move for arbitration after everyone's spent $1 million. How do we account for the absence of that without effectively saying no harm, no foul, right? Which is sort of saying no prejudice, which is, I think, one of the things the Supreme Court told us not to think about.
I certainly agree that this court should not look at prejudice any longer.
So why is the absence of significant litigation a factor in your favor as opposed to a neutral factor that we shouldn't even be thinking about?
Yeah, I think... great question. I think I have two responses. One is that Doyle expressly said it is still a factor that this court should address. It said length of time and substantial litigation conduct continue to be relevant
factors. But
analytically,
why?
So the answer to why is it's not just about the expense to the parties. It's also about whether the moving party, the defendant in this case, was seeking to get something, seeking to resolve their claims in federal court. And so if they got a lot of discovery, this is the Cabinetry case from the Seventh Circuit, they got thousands of documents. If they actually got discovery, they got something out of the federal judicial process. That activity, as it goes on, at some point waives their right to seek a second bite at the apple of that discovery.
It demonstrates that they intentionally mean to relinquish their right to arbitrate.
Exactly. And it would be a second bite of the apple to then go to a different forum and try to get that discovery again or work on their arguments a different way. Again, here, there was no resolution of the motion to dismiss and no discovery at all. They got nothing out of this case.
Is there anything in the record to indicate why the defendant waited 16 months to make the motion to compel arbitration?
So our position is that that's not relevant. It's in the record that counsel changed.
So whether it's relevant or not,
it becomes immediately relevant as soon as the question is
asked. In the record, a new counsel joined the case and then filed a letter, I think it's the next day, saying that we intend to move to arbitrate. And so that's the only reason in the record. But again, our position is that that reason does not matter.
Seems like that's the whole case is why. Because waiver is the intentional relinquishment, right? So the question is, did they do it on purpose? So if it shows that there was a litigation strategy sort of, there was a reason not to have done it in the beginning and a reason to have done it later, then it seems that the why is everything, no?
I agree that knowledge and intent is required, but I think when you look at Doyle, the question is, did the litigation conduct demonstrate an intentional relinquishment of the right? And here, the litigation conduct of moving to compel arbitration before any motion to dismiss was decided, that I think shows that it was not an intentional.
So I guess the why, in your view, matters only if the answer to the why included a statement along the following lines. We initially decided it was more in our interest to move to dismiss than to compel arbitration, and later we changed our mind. That would be a why that would hurt your case.
Potentially, Your Honor, but
that's, I mean, what I have just posited is an affirmative decision not to seek arbitration, which is a waiver, right?
Yes, and I think that would be a different case, Your Honor. And I think this all goes back to Doyle specifically saying you have to look at all aspects of the moving party's conduct, not have a bright line rule. We're not aware of any case in this court or any other court that has said that just filing a motion to dismiss before moving to compel arbitration is waiver.
Filing a motion to dismiss with prejudice. So this is a little bit of a different case, where it's not just the line run motion dismiss, there's a filing and an ask to dismiss with prejudice.
Again, Your Honor, if that motion, which I think is similar to the motion in Doyle, if the party then waited for that to be resolved before seeking arbitration as a fallback position, then I agree that would support a finding of waiver. But if the party then tried to claw back that motion before it was decided.
No. But if it waited for 16 months to claw that back, then why can't a district court judge reasonably infer from that it was an intentional relinquishment of the arbitration right?
I think because my friend on the other side hasn't cited any case that says 16 months without substantial litigation conduct shows waiver. In fact, we've cited multiple cases, including from our own district court judge, that said over a year after a motion to dismiss before moving to compel arbitration.
Putting aside whether there is any case law, I mean, was it wrong for the district court to say after all this time, I think they waived?
We think it was wrong, and we think the district court was right in the Paletti case, which came after Morgan, to hold that a period of year, many months, does not constitute waiver, especially when the motion to dismiss has not been decided. That's from our own district court judge after Morgan.
Can I ask you to address the question I had posed to your opposing counsel?
Yes, John.
About the order of operations here. Do you agree with him that if we were to agree with you that the motion to compel was improperly denied, that's what we would do? We would reverse and say, send it to arbitration, vacate the ruling on the motion to dismiss?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the FIREA claim, we do think that that should be vacated and sent to arbitration along with all of the state law claims. The one caveat is the AMLA claim, which was dismissed, is non-arbitrable, and the other side hasn't even appealed that claim. So there would be an affirmance on the AMLA dismissal.
Just on that claim.
Just on that claim.
But
our position is there is no gamesmanship. There's no fallback position here. There never has been. We want the FIREA claim and all the state law claims to be resolved by an arbitrator.
So I guess that's a way in which I'm just trying to figure out the way your interest in that. And I guess the answer is that you got no substantive ruling on the state law claim.
State law claims.
So the idea is that if you get a beneficial ruling from this court as to arbitration, you're forcing arbitration on the state law claims as well, which right now are sort of in the ether.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the FIREA claim, which the parties agreed to.
Sure, and the
FIREA
claim.
Would you just briefly, as I did with your friend on the other side, address the motion to dismiss?
Yes, Your Honor. So our position is the district court got it right. If this court does not agree with us on arbitration, moves on to the FIREA claim, they have not plausibly alleged knowledge, which they conceded in their briefs and here, that is a requirement under this statute. Temporal proximity alone is not enough to plausibly allege knowledge. The statute at issue in this case incorporates the Whistleblower Act.
So on that point, the district court cited to Forrester. Is there another case where we've said that?
So another case I would direct Your Honor to is the Ford case from 2019 from this court, which also says that temporal proximity alone is not enough to demonstrate retaliation. We also cited multiple SDNY cases dismissing on the pleadings.
What was the first case?
Ford from this court, Your Honor. But both the Loth and the Diaz decisions from the SDNY.
So the other side argues that it's not just temporal proximity. There are a number of circumstances that show the retaliation here. All four plaintiffs were on the compliance team. All four lodged complaints in one form or another. All four were fired very quickly. There's evidence of pretext, namely that they had good performance evaluations before. There's evidence that the bank stepped up their surveillance, et cetera, of them, or not evidence, allegations, I should say. Why aren't those allegations together enough on a 12B6 motion?
So those are allegations that may be relevant to a pretext decision. So they say the reasons for termination were false. Those may be relevant to pretext. They're not relevant to knowledge. They have to show that there's some reason to think.
The argument is that they show knowledge because the fact that the bank acted against all four so quickly suggests reasonably and implies that they knew of the complaints and that's what they were doing.
So I think
is that not a fair argument?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think that just falls back on the temporal proximity. The fact that they were acted against so quickly, I think, gets back to temporal proximity. But the statute itself gives an example of circumstantial evidence that would suffice. And it says evidence that the official taking the personnel action knew of the protected activity and that there was temporal proximity. That's from the whistleblower statute incorporated into FIREA. It does not say temporal proximity alone is enough. And that example, I would submit, shows that it is not. There needs to be other evidence of knowledge.
Did they, in fact, have good performance evaluation? At least that's what's alleged.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, performance?
Does the complaint allege that they have been performing well prior to this?
No, Your Honor. The complaint alleges that there was an internal audit that said they were unsatisfactory, their department, and that
the
there were 21 complaints
that,
against them.
That they had positive performance evaluations?
It alleges generally that they were excellent employees, and then it also alleges that the internal...
So if an employer fires someone who is generally an excellent employee, does that not create an issue as to whether it's pretext, the stated reason is pretextual?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I wasn't clear. I think the general allegation is conclusory, so there are not sufficient allegations of that they got positive reviews. But setting that aside, I think there has to be some reason to think that the employer knew about the FDIC complaint. And they allege, or they argue on appeal that, well, the FDIC must have or should have informed the bank and that the bank would have then assumed that it was them. But neither of those things are in the complaints. The complaint doesn't allege that the FDIC informed the bank about the complaints. And their Second Amendment complaint also doesn't allege they were the only ones making these complaints internally. They are speculating on appeal about what could have happened. And they specifically say they need deposition testimony to figure out when the FDIC contacted the bank, whether it was before or after their terminations.
So you're relying on the language for me with respect to the temporal proximity can't itself by itself support plaintiff's position here. You're also relying on Ford, and I think, is that what you said?
Ford and Forrester.
And Forrester. Is there a published opinion from the circuit on this point? In other words, Ford is also a summary order, I believe, from 2019. Forrester is a summary order. That's the one that was cited by Judge Broderick. Is there a published opinion on that issue?
I don't believe there's a published opinion interpreting this statute on that issue, though. But every single retaliation case cited by either party from any circuit has held that something more than temporal proximity is required. They have not cited a single case.
I mean, you're citing to the statute, which is knowledge. And I think it's undisputed, as you pointed out, that knowledge is a requirement, knowledge by the employer here. But yeah, as I think Judge Chin's questions indicate, there are different ways to infer, and we're at the motion dismiss stage, a defendant's knowledge. And one way might be, I think the plaintiffs are trying to point out, that you have a series of internal complaints and they overlap at least with some indicia by way of the emails that they also complained to the FDIC, which would trigger the FOIA claim. What am I missing about that?
Well, so I think what's missing there is that in their cases where there was plausibly alleged knowledge, there was something much more. There was either they told their supervisor that they had made the complaint. The supervisor knew about the complaint because they were sitting in the meeting where it happened. Or, and the Costa case from the Western District of New York, I think, is really helpful here because there was a plausible allegation of retaliation of knowledge, but it said it's because the plaintiff told her supervisor about it. And with respect to another activity that she only told a coworker about, there was no plausible allegation.
It being the
protected activity
to the FDIC or protected activity.
The protected activity, which would be the complaint to the FDIC in this case. In these cases, it was other protected activity, whistleblowing activity. But they don't allege anything.
Really, you're focused totally on not the lack of allegations that pursuant to which we might or a jury might infer knowledge. Temporal proximity is a secondary issue. If they had alleged, plausibly alleged, that the bank knew about these complaints to the FDIC, then this temporal proximity issue you wouldn't be fighting that, really.
So yes, the knowledge issue is what the district court ruled on. We actually had an alternative argument below, and there I think there are other pleading deficiencies that the district court could resolve.
But the knowledge issue is really what's before us.
That's what's driving our appeal, Your Honor. I mean, I will point out, and we pointed this out in our brief, that as far as temporal proximity goes, at least one of the plaintiffs, it was over 6 months after his complaint. That's Kuzmiak, and they don't even allege that 6 months is a short enough time. And they don't cite to any cases that actually is temporal proximity. But yes, we're focusing on the fact that there is no adequate knowledge. And I just want to focus on the IT issue for a second because that was mentioned. On appeal, they argue essentially two things. They argue that the FDIC must have contacted the bank and the bank must have put the clues together. Neither of those are in their allegations at all. They also allege that IT had a technical ability to monitor the websites that they visited. That allegation is only with respect to Adamson, who signed up for FDIC Connect, which they allege is for conducting business with the FDIC, which was their job. So whether the bank knew that they contacted the FDIC through FDIC Connect has nothing to do with their protected activity. If you look at the attachments to their complaint, all of their emails to the FDIC are on their personal email addresses, yahoo.com, icloud.com, gmail.com. None were sent from their work emails, and they don't even allege that in their complaint. And so their IT monitoring doesn't apply to any of their emails to the FDIC. All that they say is that there's a technical ability to know that they contacted the FDIC through FDIC Connect. That's it. There's a huge links in the chain.
One housekeeping matter on the arbitration.
Yes, John.
You agree, I think, that your client could have moved to compel arbitration at the outset of the litigation.
They could have, Your Honor. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Brewster.
On the arbitration issue, Doyle really piggybacks on prior holdings from this court that predate Morgan. PPG Industries, LeaderTex, both cases say preference for litigation supports a finding of waiver. That's what we have here. LeaderTex, if you could have invoked the arbitration clause at the outset of litigation, what we just talked about, and chose not to, that's waiver.
So besides Mr. Adamson, you have three other plaintiffs. Mr. Adamson is the only one as to whom there were allegations that there was a possibility, at least, that the bank would have known that he complained specifically to the FDIC. What about the other people?
The other people, the bank would still know. The others made the complaint. They were objecting internally as a team.
But the protected activity, but maybe I've misunderstood, is a complaint not internally to the bank, but to the FDIC. So how would they?
But you would know based on the content of the complaints of the FDIC that it was the plaintiffs. But the complaint also says that they were being surveilled, and so the bank would know that
these. That their email was being surveilled.
Right. That the bank would know that they were acting in concert when they brought these complaints.
Where is the set of allegations that the surveillance included emails? I thought it was from their personal emails, but that they would be able to surveil emails going to the FDIC by the three others besides Mr. Hussein.
Yeah, I don't have that. The complaint is like 500 paragraphs long, but
I know that, but you're...
I know, but I think the Adamson, there are specific allegations as to Adamson's direct contact with the FDIC, but I think the others contacted the FDIC also. You know, we don't know the extent of the surveillance that was going on at the bank, if they were monitoring what the plaintiffs were doing personally and professionally. We don't know any of this.
The surveillance was people, like unknown people appearing on Zooms. Was that was there additional specific allegations of surveillance besides that?
I think there's an allegation that bank employees from Korea were monitoring what the plaintiffs were doing also and keeping tabs on what the plaintiffs were up to, as best as the plaintiffs could assert. On the issue of knowledge and prima facie case, Forrester and Ford are summary judgment cases. Timing may not be enough to prove pretext on summary judgment. We know that from El Said, but on a motion to dismiss under Littlejohn, those cases, timing is enough to make out a prima facie case. It's a minimal burden. There's no published case in this court that I know of that says timing is not enough to make out a prima facie case under Rule 12. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I also thank the parties for helping us resolve the jurisdictional problem with respect to the motion for reconsideration. And I believe we'll reserve the decision, obviously.